Hello, everyone. We've got an interesting program today. This is Keith from Attack the System, and with me is Vince. Vince is a longtime friend of Attack the System, and what's interesting is that Vince actually lives in Portland, so he's been right in the middle of the action that's been going on in recent months. And if you follow any news at all or pay any attention to what's going on in the world at all, you know what's been happening in Portland. So I don't really need to go over the background of this. So, Vince, what's going on out there?
It's pretty crazy out here. Last night was unofficially night 100 of protests. I think it's technically like night 100. It was night 103 or 4. But everyone kind of decided that a Saturday night would be the official night 100 of 100 straight nights of protest. So we've been keeping the streak alive out here, and it got pretty crazy last night from what I understand. And it's just been an ongoing, very dynamic situation that's gone through a ton of different phases. And it's been really interesting to see it unfold. I've been out in it a few nights, and I've also watched, you know, via live stream, and then just watched after action videos and talked to people who were there on the ground. I know people who have witnessed some of the things that have made national news. I've witnessed some of that myself. I won't go into details what specifically I was there for, but it's been pretty crazy out here.
What are some of the common misconceptions that we're hearing in the national news? Because if we turn on the cable news channels, on one hand, on Fox News, of course, we hear the usual stuff, you know, communists are tearing up Portland and they're taking over the city. And the more conventional news media, we hear, well, we've got another night of clashes with police and riots and things like that. How big is this actual ongoing series of events? Is this something that's engulfed the entire city? Is this something that's going on in a particular location? Or is this something that a fairly small number of people are involved in? What's the real story with that?
That's a good question. And it depends on if you're asking that question as of right now. In general, the whole thing has been confined to a few different pockets of Portland. And most people in the city and in the greater Portland area may never even come across any protests, may not even come across any traffic from the protests. You could entirely live your life without running into any of it. There's a few pockets. There's one concentrated area downtown, and it's kind of a big square where all the government buildings are. There's a federal courthouse. Called the Justice Center, which is like the central precinct for the Portland Police and the Multnomah County Sheriff. It's where you get taken if you get arrested. You'll spend the night in that jail. There's an IRS building, City Hall. There's all clustered around three park blocks. And in the early stages up until like a month ago, the protests were almost completely confined to that kind of 3x3 block area. And then recently, it's mostly been confined to very specific buildings, usually police precincts around the city. If you don't live near one of those police precincts, you may never encounter the protest, aside from the early days when we had like 10,000 people marching through Portland.
So what is actually driving the protests? I mean, what specifically are people protesting against? I mean, we know the general narrative of, well, you know, this whole wave of protests we've seen in different places stems from the killing of George Floyd and then some of these wider social issues, police brutality and other things that are adjacent to that. But in Portland specifically, who is being protested against and why and by whom?
Right now, it's primarily targeted at the Portland Police Bureau and the mayor, Ted Wheeler, which is pretty interesting because he's a Democrat mayor. And, if you look at the right-wing media, they look at Mayor Ted Wheeler as a Democrat, and they're saying, oh, he's supporting these protests. But if you go to any of the protests, you'll hear people chanting, fuck Ted Wheeler, all night long. And he's the police commissioner. And the kind of the interesting thing about Portland, and well, not just Portland, but all of the major cities, if you look at Chicago, if you look at Seattle, Portland, LA, these all have Democrat mayors. So there is some credibility to when I think the right wing criticizes, you know, these shithole cities that are high crime and where all this police violence is occurring. That's actually true. Like these are all Democrat cities. This is a Democrat controlled city. It's a Democrat city commissioners, Democrat mayor, and we have this out of control police bureau that's the majority of them are from the outlying suburbs and more conservative counties, and from across the river in Washington, and Clark County is where all the actual Portland police live. And they come into Portland, which is a Democrat controlled city, and they beat the crap out of protesters every night. So I think primarily the protests are targeted at the people who are left in the streets at this point after 100 nights are pretty hardcore police abolitionists and, you know, people who advocate for pretty hardcore police reform that's very adjacent to police abolition, you know, to the point of completely defanging the police. That's who's left in the streets at this point. And a lot of those people, you know, if you look at the actual radical population, there's not a whole lot of actual anarchists and radical people. But what's happened is a lot of normal, everyday Portlanders have been radicalized throughout this process because, you know, you can see it happening every night. And it's, you know, at this point, it's pure naked force that they're using to drive people off the streets. They don't have a whole lot of credibility, I'd say. The police don't have a whole lot of credibility at this point.
What was the situation that was getting a lot of attention in Portland recently where troops from the Department of Homeland Security were sent in? Because the narrative we were getting in the press, particularly from the Trump administration, was, well, Ted Wheeler, whom you mentioned earlier, he's, you know, he can't control the city, so we're going to send the feds in to do it for him because protesters are threatening the federal building or something like that. That's the, you know, it's one spin we were getting on it. But what actually happened there?
Yeah, so that was kind of an interesting situation. And I think what happened was in the very early stages of the protests, you know, we had 10,000 or more people marching in the streets, and they weren't all at that point, you know, not everyone marching was a police abolitionist or an anarchist. It was just a lot of, you know, normal everyday people, progressive liberals, the full spectrum of people from Portland were marching. And at that point, the central place where everyone was protesting was what I mentioned earlier, the Justice Center, which is the central precinct for Portland Police Bureau and the sheriff, the Multnomah County Sheriff. Portland is in Multnomah County. And on either side of that building, on one side was the federal courthouse. And on the other side of that is another federal office building. And very early on, the federal courthouse got its windows broken, the front of it got completely wrecked and tagged up with graffiti. But it wasn't really the focus of protests. Everyone was trying to get to the Injustice Center. And early on in the whole movement, the people broke into the Injustice Center and set it on fire. And that's where the concentration, that's where the building everyone was attacking, was the central precinct of the police bureau here. And then the federal building next door was kind of, no one even really knew what that building was in the early stages. We just knew that there were, if you looked in through the windows, you could see what turned out to be federal police officers like DHS and the federal Protective Services, the federal police that protect like federal buildings. You could see them in there, but they never came out. And it was just the local goons. What happened is back in, was it around the 4th of July, I think, late June, early July, I think Trump switched his narrative to, for his reelection campaign, to like law and order. And up until that point, people had just been, if you went, even now, if you go and look, like the front of the federal building was completely tagged up with graffiti, fuck pigs, fuck 12, like all sorts of awesome stuff like that. Just completely covered in graffiti. And I think Trump decided that he was going to plant his flag there and, you know, make a hill to die on. So he decided to mobilize BORTAC, the border, it's basically the equivalent of SWAT, the SWAT team for the Border Patrol, and sent them into Portland to rough up the protesters and I think kind of rile up his base. So that kind of, up until that point, I remember back in early July, like every once in a while, these dudes in camo would come running out of the federal building and try to make an arrest or come out and shoot at protesters. And then they'd run back in. And everyone's just like, who are these guys in camo? Do we have National Guard? Are these like militia members? And no one even knew who they were at that point. But then once he made the big mobilization, that's when everyone realized, okay, this is, everyone started looking into what that building was and who was coming out of it to shoot at protesters. And that kind of set the stage for that stage of the protests here in Portland.
Well, as far as the shooting of protesters, now a lot of the videos or photographs that I've seen show that people clearly have been wounded seriously in these shootings that have been carried out by the police. To my knowledge, there has not yet been a fatal shooting carried out by the police or by the feds, but there have been serious incidents of people being wounded and you know, injured. Who is doing the shooting? Is it the feds that are doing the shooting? Is it the local police that are doing the shooting? Is it all of it? What is it that they're shooting? Are they shooting rubber bullets? Are they shooting something like blanks? Or, you know, they use a number of different things like that in these kinds of situations. So who's getting shot and who's doing the shooting and what are they shooting with?
Yeah, so it's probably the worst shootings that you've seen in the national news as far as protesters go when they're shooting protesters has been DHS officers, usually like BORTAC, who I mentioned earlier, and ICE, who's out there as well. They seem to be going for headshots. They call them rubber bullets, but it's like a baton round. It's like a plastic encased something or other that it shoots out of it shoots out of a special gun. Portland police have certainly been doing that as well. And Portland police have used a pretty wide variety of like pepper balls, the baton rounds, which most people refer to as rubber bullets, CS gas, tear gas, and then some kind of shotgun device that spreads like plastic or rubber shot into the crowd. But the major incidents that have made national news was one of the Wall of Moms people. I don't know if you recall, but a whole bunch of Portland mothers came out dressed in yellow. And the DHS officers shot one of them in the face, like right in the forehead. And that was the one that got the most widespread national media coverage because it was just like a normal mom that got shot in the face. And lots of other people have been shot, mostly in the torso or in the leg. But it seemed like BORTAC was going for headshots because they shot a few press people in the head and they shot the mom in the face. And most of what I'm aware of coming from Portland police has been shots to the torso and legs. But it really seemed like the federal officers were out there headhunting.
You mentioned that they've used CS gas. One thing I would point out about that is that that's actually illegal under international law. The Geneva Convention banned the use of that in warfare way back in 1925. And the United States is a signatory nation to that treaty. So yeah. The United States is actually using these items illegally, according to international law and according to U.S. federal law, because that's a treaty that applies to the U.S. federal system as well.
Yeah.
So they're essentially committing war crimes then is what it amounts to.
And they're blanketing entire neighborhoods with it. Like I said, a lot of the protests have kind of moved since DHS, quote unquote, left. They haven't really left, but it was kind of a stand down order. most of the protests have moved to the outlying precincts, like in East Portland and North Portland. And it's been moving across these various different locations, which are either in or adjacent to residential neighborhoods. So last night it was at East Portland Precinct, which is about 4 or 5 miles east of downtown. And where it actually is, there's like a community center there. There's like a huge strip mall with like a Home Depot. But what they did is they chased everyone out of that area into a residential neighborhood, and they completely blanketed the entire neighborhood with tear gas. And this has happened repeatedly over the past 100 nights, where they've chased people into residential neighborhoods and the whole residential neighborhood gets tear gassed. And so now we have reports and, you know, people on Twitter and calling the mayor's office saying that they were, you know, asleep in their house and tear gas came into their house. And, you know, we have people who are having to like go to hotels for the night, or people buying respirators for when the police start tear gassing their neighborhood. And yeah, they're completely blanketing pockets of Portland in tear gas. And you know, every night they do that, they turn more of the population against them.
As far as the backstory to the beginnings of the protests, what I noticed was the general trend nationwide when these protests started in late May, early June, was that initially there was something of an insurrection by what we might call the lumpen proletariat, and that is the sophisticated term for just the urban poor, basically.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we saw all the scenes of expropriations taking place at Targets and places like that. And then it seems like the whole uprising has gone through multiple stages. Initially you had this kind of lower class uprising, and then you also had more of a conventional protest movement, you know, as you would for any issue, you know, oppose the war or something like that. And then there's also been a wave of attacks on monuments and statues and things like that, you know, more of a culture war type of paradigm. And then also there just seems to be a lot of, you know, hangers-on that have joined in on in different places, you know, where you have people setting up encampments in the street and stuff like that. All of these things have happened in my local area. But what's been the general narrative as to how all this has unfolded in Portland? Because it seemed to me, just my observations, is that there's really multiple movements in one. It's not even just one movement in a lot of places. It's a lot of different things going on at the same time. And I think that's something a lot of the media misses, the mainstream media, that, you know, it's, you know, whatever spin they put on it, they make it look like this is, you know, either a protest movement against social injustice, or it's, you know, leftists and commies and crazy people rioting, or, you know, whatever their spin is. But it actually seems like it's a lot more complex than that.
Yeah, it's I would say it's extremely complex, especially, and that's one of the things I've really liked about this, is how completely out of control it is. And even the local anarchists and like your typical anti-fascist organizations that would be sort of, and this doesn't apply to all of them, but that this certainly applies to some of them, no one has been able to gatekeep this movement. No one has been able to, like, I think it was you who said, you were talking about strategically, if we're, for instance, if we're doing a strike, we don't ask everyone coming to the picket line whether or not they're for or against abortion before they show up. Like, and that's been the case with this, especially in the first few nights, because literally the full weight of the people who came out was so big that no one could gatekeep the movement. And like the urban underclass came out and showed out in, you know, 5 out of 5, as far as I'm concerned, how they performed. Because all of the looting that you hear about, like that was all the urban underclass who came out in the streets and really just tore stuff up. I mean, I was down there a few of the nights in the very early stages, and, you know, you saw there were homeless people out there. There were people who were obviously from the, you know, the very poorer parts of towns. You had what I could only describe as some kind of traveling tribe of primitivists who showed up with baseball bats and chains, like coming to loot. You had a lot of bored teenagers who came from the outlying areas. You had a lot of street racers out there with their souped up cars. It was just such a wild, crazy mix of people that there was really no one defining characteristic in the early stage. It was just everyone who was fed up with the current system or bored. And I would say that to me looked like the closest thing to Attack the System's like pan-anarchist movement, which was just everyone who had any kind of beef with the system was out there. And including people who were just bored because it was the freaking pandemic and we were all under quarantine. And it was very much like an extremely dangerous party atmosphere. It was like the most dangerous party I've ever been to, is kind of how I've described it. Go ahead.
I definitely think the pandemic fed into this, because I know a guy who used to be a prison guard. He told me, yeah, this is what happens in prison when everybody's been under lockdown for a while. You know, you have people, a bunch of people get caught with contraband, so they put the whole block under lockdown, and then you bring them their food and they hit you in the face with a tray. You know, it's so it's like a sort of a nationwide prison riot, basically.
Yeah.
3 months of house arrest.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it was, especially that first week, I'd say. And, you know, at that point, anarchists have been, you know, radical people have been in the streets since day one. And like I said, they had no ability to gatekeep the system, to gatekeep the movement. But what they did land in these early days in Portland was a lot of people who had experience with like standing up to police in a riot. So, you know, we had people showing up in Black Block the very first few nights with like all the gear to get tear gassed in and to stand up to rubber bullets and all that sort of thing and shields. So it was a combination of street tactics of the absolute kind of pandemonium that came with all of the people from the bored people from the outlying areas and the lumpen proletariat, along with some of the organizational skills and street tactics that like anarchists and other radical leftists have developed over the years. And those two forces combined, especially in the early days, backed by the sheer weight of people in the streets, like the cops were not able to drive people off the streets.
One thing that we've been hearing about happening in Portland, and this has happened in other places as well, is there have been cases where protesters have been disappeared. That is, you have vans, unmarked vehicles and vans that have shown up and drag people away and taking them to jail or whatever. What's the story behind that?
Yeah, so I would say that really started with when the federal involvement began, with DHS police coming in. And what they did and what we found out was that these vans were actually rental vans. And a bunch of people did a bunch of research and they were enterprise rental vans. And I think DHS Secretary Chad Wolf said that they were preemptive arrests, or he used some kind of language like that. They were, you know, we have to be out there proactively arresting people. And, you know, their story is that they, you know, these were targeted arrests of people that were suspected of, you know, throwing rocks or throwing fireworks at police or whatever. But I mean, really what it looked like is, you know, they had a description of someone dressed in all black who threw something at the police. And they were really just circling the whole protest area like sharks, just kind of picking off stray protesters, anyone who was in Black Block. And just kind of, I think, waging a campaign of terror is what I think it was essentially trying to scare people off the streets by, you know, snatching a few protesters and disappearing them into vans. And, you know, some of the stories that came out of this is where they were driven around for a while, taken into some underground parking structure, like searched, and in many cases just let go or put in jail, and then there was no charges. And so they just ended up walking. So in many of those cases, there was no real, you know, they didn't as they didn't have any probable cause because it was just a fishing expedition of grabbing someone dressed in black and searching through their stuff to see if they could find fireworks or weapons or anything like that, and then cutting them loose if they couldn't find anything. So I think it was just a campaign of terror, just trying to scare people off the streets.
They used to do that during the protest movements in the 60s during the Vietnam War era. That tactic was used back then as well. There was this one situation where one of the Chicago Seven, Jerry Rubin, that happened to him in Chicago during the riots in 1968. He was abducted off the street like that by the Chicago police. And there was actually a guy observing it who was a journalist for some conservative newspaper. But this guy had actually spent time in Eastern Europe, and he actually wrote an article, I think it was for the New York Times, one of the big papers, criticizing this, saying, yeah, when I was under, you know, living under these Stalinist regimes, I used to see this all the time. You know, this is what you're doing, you're bringing Stalinism to the United States.
Yeah.
But I think that's the point, though. I think what they're trying to do is, as you were saying, they're trying to use this as a tool of intimidation, saying we can disappear you, you know, we can Saddam Hussein you if we want, you know, that kind of, yeah. You know, implicitly trying to send that kind of message. Now, as far as some of the other incidents that have happened, I believe there have been, there was a shooting recently. There was a gentleman who was shot and killed who was believed to be a member of the Patriot Prayer Group, I think. I'm not sure if I'm getting all the information right, yeah. But from what I've heard, this man was a member of this Patriot Prayer, which is some sort of, I don't know if it's an alt-right group or maybe it's just one of these patriot type groups, but it's something like that. And he was apparently shot and killed. And then the man accused of killing him was another individual who's believed to be associated with the anti-fascist or something like that. And then the federal agents went to, I believe, probably, I don't know if it was the U.S. Marshals or one of these other federal agencies, there's so many federal police state agencies, went to arrest him, and then he was killed by the feds during the arrest process. So what do you know about this story?
Yeah, so the person killed, I think his last name was Danielson, something Danielson. I don't remember his exact name. He went by Jay. I think he was a known member of Patriot Prayer, which is, you know, at the very least alt-right, and at the very worst, kind of a proto-fascist, like Christian flag-waving sort of organization that has a history, long history of coming to Portland and getting in violent confrontations with radical leftists here. Back, you know, leading up to the whole Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, they were kind of the Portland Portland version of that whole scene that was happening. And since that time, you know, some of their people have gone on to join the Proud Boys. And they're well known in this area. And they mostly come from across the Columbia River in Washington. Vancouver, Washington is a suburb of Portland, or a bedroom community of Portland. It's part of the greater metro area. And there are far, far more conservatives from that area than there are in Portland proper. So they typically come in from Washington State, from just across the river, to get into these confrontations with radical leftists. And it's, you know, in the past 3 or 4 years, fights have broken out, big street brawls have broken out between Patriot Prayer, Proud Boys, and anti-fascists here in Portland. So leading up to all this, everyone knew that these sort of people would be kind of coming in and lurking around the protests. And it's really been recently that they've been holding these bigger rallies, highly confrontational, largely attended rallies here in the city center, with all of these alt-right and fascist people coming into the city center to essentially get in brawls. So he came in with Patriot Prayer, and that whole situation unfolded. And, you know, I don't know the specifics of like what went down right when the shooting happened. I've seen a few videos, but my understanding is the guy who did the shooting was, you know, a self-identified anti-fascist, and claimed to be a veteran. And then afterwards fled to Washington State up in the kind of greater Seattle Tacoma area. And I think it was U.S. Marshals and some local law enforcement. And the feeling around here is that he was Fred Hamptoned, that the police went into the situation with the idea that they're just going to kill the guy and assassinate him. So they rolled in. And if you look at the news coverage of us, of this, there's like three or four different versions of exactly what happened, depending on if you ask the local police, the U.S. Marshals, or neighbors who actually witnessed the event. Some people say he had like an assault rifle. Some people say he was unarmed. Like, some people say he pulled a handgun. There's just so many different versions of what that, you know, it's very unclear, and we may never know the specifics of what happened, but a lot of people think that it was just an assassination, targeted retribution.
As far as the participants in the incidents that are happening in Portland, now you mentioned that the protest movement has largely been people from all walks of life, and including people who've been radicalized by circumstances. And you've mentioned that some radical leftists have been involved in this, but which, and in Portland is well known for being sort of a hotbed of kind of radical left activism. But how much of the violence, or at least the perception of violence that has been associated with what's going on in Portland, has involved actual clashes between different political groups, left wing or right wing or whatever, as opposed to, say, protests against, say, the police or clashes with the police?
Sorry, you're asking who's involved in those?
Yeah, well, I'm asking who's involved, and I'm also asking, as far as the perception that a lot of people outside of Portland have, is okay, this ongoing violence in Portland. Now, is the violence exaggerated? You know, because as we talked about that a little bit, because we talked about how some people have this image that the whole city's in a state of siege, yeah, or something like that. Right. So we've clarified that a bit, and then, but I'm curious to know how much of the violence or street commotion is actual clashes between left-wing and right-wing groups, and how much of it is more of an actual protest movement against the police, right, or the city government, or the feds, or whatever.
Yeah, well, I think it was it late August? I think it was about 2 weeks ago was the first real major clash, when they literally Proud Boys flew in from like Florida and California and all over the United States to get in the streets. And, you know, they called it a flag waving, but they showed up with like guns and paintball guns filled with pepper balls and baseball bats and all sorts of stuff. So I think it was either 2 or 3 weeks ago was the first really big clash. And prior to that, you had had some like local pushback from like, what do they call it? Back the blue in like thin blue line sort of people who would go downtown and wave American flags and those thin blue line flags in front of the Justice Center for like an hour in the middle of the day when all of the radical people and protesters were sleeping it off. So it's really only been two weekends that had really big clashes. And one was that the first one I mentioned where they literally flew in people from out of town, Proud Boy brawlers. And then I think it was last weekend with the truck rally where they paraded through downtown from one of the outlying suburbs that's more conservative. So it's really been just those two big clashes. And to be fair, those have been extremely violent clashes. Obviously someone got killed in one of them. But they were almost like they were planned events. So as far as I know, it hasn't devolved into like random street fighting during the week. It's mostly like these planned rallies that people from out of town are like, we're going to go into Portland and, you know, show the commies that they can't take over. And then they show up armed, and then the radical left shows up ready to rumble as well. So it's really been two big clashes. And as you know, I could walk outside, I could even go downtown and where all the protests typically happened in the past, and I'd be fine. There'd be no issues with that.
Now, one other thing that I've heard about is apparently there was a caravan of trucks that went to Portland. It was something like a caravan of 600 trucks. And I assume that these were anti-protester protesters or something, or Trumpers, or maybe they were associated with some of these Proud Boy or Patriot prayer groups and things like that. But who exactly were these people, and what were they doing, and what was the result of this incident?
Yeah, so that was, I think that was last weekend. And that was a combination of Trump supporters, and this was true of the first big clash that happened a few weeks ago. Trump supporters and Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer, excuse me. And, you know, it was billed as like a Trump rally, like we're going to caravan through Portland with our Trump flags. But it was really, you know, they were basically doing drive-by shootings with paintball guns through downtown Portland. And what happened is they all gathered in a more conservative suburb, and hundreds of cars and trucks caravaned into Portland. You know, there's lots of videos of like a truck with a whole bunch of people in the back of it with like paintball guns and bear mace macing counter protesters in downtown Portland and that sort of thing. So they came through, and it was just another one of the, like I said, it's almost like these scheduled competing rallies that happen where people just sort of clash and violence breaks out. And that was the event that later on in the night kind of devolved into sort of decentralized street fights all through downtown. And that's when the shooting occurred. The Patriot Prayer member.
Just as an interesting aside, when you see these people with the Blue Lives Matter flags, they have the U.S. flag with the blue strip in the middle. That's actually against federal law. I don't know if it's illegal in a criminal sense, but the actual federal code in terms of how to treat the flag considers that to actually be desecrating the flag. So they're desecrating the flag when they do that. I mean,
yeah, it's a, definitely. Yeah,
not worried about it, but it's that's an interesting irony there. One thing that I think is a question that's come up in some circles that I want to ask you about is you mentioned people flying in from other places, these Proud Boy or Patriot Prayer people, and I've heard people from the other side, from the political right, talk about or make accusations that leftist protesters are being flown in from different places. I know recently there was a confrontation between some protesters and Rand Paul in the Senator Rand Paul in Washington, and he was making this claim, well, these people are being flown in from other places to, you know, cause trouble or whatever. I don't know to what degree there's any truth to any of these kinds of accusations, but I do think it's interesting that you apparently do have people somewhere that have the means to fly places, you know, in the middle of a pandemic when flights are minimal in terms of availability, and they just happen to be able to bring paintball guns and stuff with them, you know, stuff you're not normally supposed to transport on a plane. Do you know of any evidence of anyone that's actually, you know, providing funding for any of these kinds, I mean, left-wing or right-wing groups? Who's providing funding or transportation services for any of these groups?
Yeah, so I think it's happening on both sides, but probably not to the degree that all the conspiracy theories think it's occurring. And we have one guy, Alan Swinney, who is an alt-right Proud Boy kind of person. I think he has like Proud Boy tattooed on his arm somewhere. And I've seen him, and he's literally camping in the National Forest here with a group of people. And I know that they kind of crowdsource funding to move across the country. Like, he's shown up on the East Coast for things. He's shown up in Seattle and Portland. He's from Texas, and he has like GoFundMe campaigns to fund his movement around the country and participate in these things. So we do know that that's happening on the right, it does happen on the left to some degree. Like, I'm aware of people, especially Seattle and Portland, have a lot of cross pollination of our radical movements. So you'll have people moving between those two communities. And then we've had people there's a whole bunch of like mutual aid projects that have helped sustain this movement for 100, like you can't do 100 nights straight of protesting without some sort of organizational capacity behind it. It's all highly decentralized anarchist organization. And one of those is we have a few different, we call them all blocks, like snack block and like, we have a snack van that it's this guy that has this runner van that, and it's all graffitied with like Black Lives Matter and all sorts of anarchist stuff tagged on it. And he crowdsources funds to keep this van running. The police are constantly slashing his tires and arresting him. But he crowdsourced funds to fill his van full of medical gear and snacks for the protesters to keep people out in the streets. And he went to Washington last weekend, and he got arrested there. And they since let him go with no charges. But that would be one instance of like one of our people going across country to support the protests in Washington, D.C. But that was crowdsourced. It all comes from like, you know, $1 to $10 donations. There's no George Soros behind all of this on the left. I'm yet to see my check. I'm waiting for my check from George Soros. I want my check and my AK-47 if he's listening. But it does happen on both sides. But I think it's just not to the degree that people think. It's people self-funding themselves, or, you know, if you can get some sort of crowdsourced funds from people, then yeah, you can go across the country to do this. But it's, I think people are, for some reason, they're baffled that there's widespread hatred of the police. And it just confuses them that, oh, someone in my own city hates the police. That couldn't be. It must be some of those criminals from Portland who are coming here. It's like, no, you actually have people in your city that hate the police and are getting out there and protesting.
Well, on that note, what has been the reaction of the Portland city government to the protests, or for that matter, the Portland police? I mean, other than the things we've already discussed, like them shooting rubber bullets and stuff like that. One thing that I have noticed, and you alluded to this earlier, because from, you know, Fox News or something like that, we'll always hear about, well, these Democrat-run cities, you know, they don't value law and order, or you know, these Democrat mayors like Ted Wheeler, they can't, you know, keep basic order in their own cities. Now, what I have noticed actually happens with that is, as you said, that a lot of these large urban centers do have Democratic Party administrations. Most of them do. But what they typically do, in my experience, I've seen this in my area and in other areas as well, is that on one hand, when they're in front of the TV cameras, they'll frequently give lip service to all this, you know, they say all the right platitudes, right, basically. But then behind closed doors, it's a whole different matter. You know, they're just as conservative as Republicans about, you know, law and order and also in terms of just policies, economic policies in general. They tend to try to block anything that's going to lead to any economic development that's actually going to help the poor. They're really big on pandering to the gentrifying class and this kind of stuff, this kind of urban cosmopolitan professional class, you know, the professional managerial class. In fact, there was an interesting article in the New York Times a while back by the former mayor of Minneapolis, who admitted to all this. She was saying, yeah, you know, you have these mostly white, upper middle class people who are Democrats politically and think of themselves as liberal, and they'll say all the right things in public, but behind closed doors, it's a whole different matter, you know, when it's something that's actually going to put, you know, impact their pocketbook interests, or, you know, lead to, you know, any poor people being in their neighborhood or something like that. Yeah. So is that how it works in Portland as well? Or?
That's very much how it works in Portland. And like we've discussed, Ted Wheeler's a Democrat. And, you know, this, I think this is an example of like, this is basic counterinsurgency, like, which is you saw this happening. It continues to happen. Is the narrative of good protester versus bad protester. And, you know, ever since the beginning, they've been like, oh yeah, we believe Black Lives Matter. If you go to Ted Wheeler's Twitter account, he has his pronouns, like, you know, how everyone lists their pronouns these days. He has his pronouns listed on his Twitter account, like him, his, or whatever that stuff is. And So he, you know, they, like you said, they pay all this lip service to, like, we believe Black Lives Matter, we believe in police reform. But then, it, you know, he's the police commissioner in the city, like the mayor is the police commissioner. And then when it comes to actually the protests, his cops are shooting at protesters all night, every night. So yeah, it's very much like the Democrats are essentially the counterinsurgency element of all of this, which is an attempt to divide the good protesters from the bad protesters, say, hey, we can work with these kind of reformists over here. And I think they're shocked that it's not working, that here in Portland, like, people are onto them and are onto that bullshit and not falling for it for the most part. But and part of the reason for that is the cops just are not capable of waging a competent counterinsurgency. They just get so pissed off that someone dares to stand up to their authority that they do all this shit, and it's all caught on video, and there's no denying any of it. And it creates a wedge between them and the community when really, like, if a competent counterinsurgency was occurring, you wouldn't be feeding the insurgency with all these images of police brutality and being, you know, blanketing entire residential neighborhoods with tear gas. So yeah, I think from the political establishment is attempting to pay lip service to this and get sort of piecemeal reforms in, while the cops in the street are just using, you know, naked force to attempt to drive protesters off the streets, beat the crap out of people, like, scare people into staying home every night. Yeah.
I've seen that many times going back for quite some time. Back in the late 80s, I was in about four different riots in the space of about a year and a half. One was in Washington, D.C., one was in Toronto, Canada, one was in San Francisco, and one was in New York City. And at that time, those were probably the four most quote-unquote liberal cities in North America, mm-hmm. along with Los Angeles. Maybe nowadays Portland or Seattle or somewhere like that has surpassed them. But back in those days, those were like the liberal cities of North America. And in every one of these cases, it was the same story. You had this liberal city administration that would give all these lip services to, you know, we believe in the right to protest, we believe in this cause. Meanwhile, their cops are out beating people up and shooting people. Well, except for New York. Ed Koch was the mayor of New York at the time. He was a liberal Democrat. And his rhetoric was just like Trump. You know, we've got anarchists taking over our cities and like that. And in Canada, when I was in Canada, they have a reputation for being a supposedly liberal nation compared to the United States. And Toronto was considered, or back then, was considered their most liberal city. Today is probably Vancouver. But it was the same way there. You actually saw the Mounties, the horseback police, out, you know, swinging batons and hitting people in the head while they're on the horses, and then shooting tear gas and stuff like that as well. And in fact, a short time, this wasn't while I was there, but a short time before that, when Trudeau Sr., Pierre Trudeau, Justin Trudeau's father, was prime minister, there had been an insurrection by the Quebecois separatists, and he actually imposed martial law. Which has never really happened in the United States, at least not in recent history, modern history. What would you say is the demographic breakdown of the protest movement in the Portland area? I mean, in terms of race, or in terms of gender, or in terms of perhaps class background, or just cultural background, ages, you know, politics, any of these kinds of things. I mean, how diverse is all of this?
Well, Portland itself is extremely white. It's like one of the whitest cities in America. So we're often criticized by the right, like, hey, it's like, you don't have any black people out there protesting. It's all a bunch of white people. And for the most part, that's true, but it's truly a reflection of our racial diversity out there. And I would say, even though the protest crowd is majority white, it's probably more racially diverse than the general population. So in the actual protest crowd, you will see a higher percentage of black people, a higher percentage of Native American and Hispanic people than the general population. But if it is majority white, it's a reflection of Portland's just straight up whiteness. And then in terms of like political background, you know, there's always a good contingent of anarchists, but Portland does not have enough anarchists to sustain 100 straight nights of rioting. You know, we have the participation of, you know, radicalized people, mostly on the left, who, or if they're not anarchists, they're at least police abolitionists at this point. It's a very common story to hear people be like, well, I was kind of a liberal Democrat or I was a progressive the first few nights of the protesting. And I thought like, oh, you know, we need to reform the police. And I was shocked at like all of the violence I saw like coming from protesters. And then now at night 100, they're like, no, there's no reforming the police. Like, we need to abolish the police. And, you know, the tamest of them are basically like, we need to fire all the police and build like community safety from the ground up. And so there's a contingent of people who are, I would say they're not like politically radical in the sense that they're not anarchists, they're not communists, but they're basically like, we need to start over from scratch with our police department. We essentially need to kick everyone out and build, reconceptualize what, you know, community safety is. I said earlier, one of the great things about this whole thing is just how politically, racially diverse this whole thing has been since the beginning. And there's a really good podcast on It's Going Down. I know we don't always see eye to eye with It's Going Down, but if you look it up, I think it's called How It Might Should Be Done. And it's a Black anarchist talking about how, like, how bullshit like identity politics is. And he says, like, when you're out in the street, like, we've essentially smashed all of these racial, class, whatever boundaries. And you realize, like, all this sort of academic BS behind identity politics and all of this is really just, you know, building barriers between us. And, you know, when you're actually out there in the street, none of that matters. And it's probably, like, you know, obviously I'm Native American. I'm as brown as they come among Native Americans. And, you know, I've seen my fair share of racism and that sort of thing. And I don't think I really loved Portland until like I was out there in these protest movements. And you know, for as critical as we are at attack the system of where the left is going, like, I think the left losing control of this protest movement is probably the best thing that could have happened. And just seeing the way it's kind of sustained itself over the past 100 nights has been pretty incredible.
Another aside I'll throw in is that one of the reasons why Oregon has such a predominantly white population is because Blacks for a long time were actually legally banned from living in Oregon. I mean, when that territory was created, it was actually the law that they actually banned Blacks from settling there.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, there's a legacy to that as well. What about any kind of reforms or changes that you think might come out of this? For example, are the Portland police going to be abolished, or is there going to be any kind of systemic reforms that are short of abolition? Because when people today talk about defunding the police and all that, that's become kind of a slogan. And of course, the other side, you know, picks up on that and says, oh, that's crazy, you're going to have chaos. But, you know, but the thing is, a lot of the people who talk about defunding the police don't really mean that. They just want to, you know, spend more money on other things, you know, or they want to maybe change the way policing is structured. For instance, they always point to Camden, New Jersey as a model. But what Camden, New Jersey did was they just abolished the police department so they could break the union contract with the police union, and then they actually hired more police, but they did it under the umbrella of an adjacent town, I believe is how they did it. So what do you see coming out of this in terms of any kind of changes like that?
Well, I think early on what you saw happen was like the reformists like jumping out of the gate to get in front of all of this and provide a bunch of like piecemeal reforms that they thought would keep a lid on everything and maintain the status quo. So what we did get kind of immediately was an end to safety resource officers in high schools. They also got rid of our, I forget what, it's like the gun violence task force. And that used to be the gang unit here in town that was kind of notoriously like racist. If you're black and you know someone in a gang, then you get put in the gang database. And, you know, and that's true. Like LA has a similar model where essentially I know people who are in the LA gang database because they dated someone who was like the daughter of a gang member, and they're still in the gang database there or whatever. So they rebranded that to the Gun Violence Task Force, and it's now been dismantled. And then they also used to be, you know, when marijuana was legalized here, they had a city tax, and that city tax money went straight to the police, which was kind of like, oh, the police have to wet their beak if you're going to legalize marijuana. Well, that's no longer the case. I mean, that's organized crime right there. That's like, it's essentially just organized crime. You got to pay your protection money to the Portland police in order to sell marijuana now. So that's done. And I think people thought, well, if we give them a few of these things, then everyone will be happy and will stay home. And that just hasn't happened. So I think, you know, I'm a police abolitionist. I'm an anarchist. I believe in overthrowing the government and all of that. But I think we should aim high and get whatever we can. And, you know, I'm to some degree, I'm realistic about what we can actually attain in all of this. Ideally, I'd love if this turned into the revolution. But I think if we can at least get rid of the police unions, like that would be a huge step in the I don't know that it would fundamentally change policing in the United States, but it would certainly put a huge dent in the police's ability to keep like all of these corrupt cops on the force. You know, people who have a history of brutalizing people and murdering people on the police force, they're kept on the police force because of these union contracts, these police unions. So like here in Portland, a lot of the protests have been aimed at the Portland Police Union's clubhouse, which is in North Portland, and the people have set fire to it a number of times. It gets tagged up with graffiti. The police hate it when the protests go to that building. Like they absolutely hate it. And we've seen some of the worst police violence when we go to that building. And the general feeling is they don't want the police union in the discussion because they're the police union is the thing behind closed doors where these contracts get negotiated between the city and the police force. So I would hope that we can at least get rid of police unions, if not, you know, abolish the police altogether.
As far as the history behind some of these task forces and special police units and stuff like that, the whole story behind that is interesting. Like all of that begins about 50 years ago. Prior to about 50 years ago, the way policing in the United States had worked since the late 19th century, had been that mostly law enforcement was a local matter. Now local police were problematic. For example, in the South, you would have local sheriffs that doubled as Grand Dragons of the Ku Klux Klan or something like that. And in northern cities, it was an issue too. You had cops that were just, you know, localized thugs, basically, and often were in league with, say, just local political machines as sort of their enforcer arm or local organized crime and things like that. And then the feds in those days largely dealt with crime across state lines alcohol prohibition was going on, they were enforcing that. That's how we actually got the BATF. And then also the political police, you know, the FBI, that's what they were. They were set up by the Wilson administration as the political police to investigate anarchists and communists and labor radicals and stuff in World War I. But starting around 1970, what you start to see is the local police start to become more militarized in the sense you start to see these SWAT teams being developed, and you start to see all of these special forces type units start to develop that local police typically did not have prior to that. Like Daryl Gates, who was the former police chief of LA, he actually was the pioneer in that. He would create these paramilitary SWAT police forces, and then those started to spread to other jurisdictions. So you start to see local police departments developing these paramilitary units, and they were created largely to fight with groups like the Black Panthers and radical groups that were involved, you know, that were around back then, or to control anti-war protests and student riots, which were big back then. And then parallel to that, you see start to see this massive expansion of the federal police state, because you had Richard Nixon's war on drugs that was used as a cover for this, because what they started doing was they started pouring money, a lot of money, into state and local police departments under the guise, federal money, under the guise of fighting the war on drugs. And it was used for, to expand these kinds of operations, these kinds of, Nixon basically used the war on drugs to create a federal police state that where he basically nationalized local law enforcement, and then used, these federal block grants and all of these methods that the states, that the feds use to finance the states. They use those to create these localized military, paramilitary forces as well. And that's why we have all the stuff we have today, the SWAT teams and gang enforcement units and all these special narcotic squads and all that kind of stuff. In addition to expanding all these alphabet soup, like, for example, the DEA was created in 1973 under Richard Nixon. And then they started to build up all these other alphabet soup agencies like that. And of course, after 9/11, when they created the Department of Homeland Security, that's an umbrella for something like 30 different federal police organizations, some of which didn't even exist a few decades ago. So like, I know ICE came about as through the consolidation of what they used to call the Customs Unit, which was ostensibly they were just sort of like a variation of the Border Patrol. And then they expanded them into a domestic police force that's ostensibly supposed to be investigating illegal immigration and things like that. So it's really interesting to see how this massive police state that we have in the United States has developed over the past half a century. And the fact that it's also interconnected as well. Like, I hear a lot of people talk about defunding the police or abolish the police, and they're mostly talking about these municipal police units. But behind that, you've also got the state police, who are heavily intertwined. You know, every state has its own police department, and you've got these state police units that are heavily intertwined with local city and county police. Cities and counties usually often have multiple police departments. They'll have the sheriff's departments, which tend to run the jails and stuff like that, and then the actual police who do the patrol work and that kind of stuff. And then behind the states and localities, you've got the federal police agencies, and then they intersect with local law enforcement in all kinds of ways. And they've got their hands in all kinds of other things, like emergency response, like natural disasters. And so it's amazing how wide this apparatus is. So I guess my point is, to really defund the police or abolish the police, we've really got to overthrow the whole government to make that work.
Yeah, there's multiple layers. And the interesting thing is, like, it's been a crash course for a lot of Portlanders of what the police state is and how many agencies have control over our lives. Because, you have people who were pretty new to these sort of protest movements coming in and not knowing really who they were facing off with. And now they could describe to you what you just described. And now they know, like, oh, tonight we're facing off against the sheriffs. Where, like, tonight we're facing off against the Portland Police Bureau, or tonight it's going to be the Oregon State Police, or tonight it's going to be DHS. And depending on which agency you're facing off against, like, you literally have to shift your tactics. It's like, okay, well, if we get arrested by the Portland Police Bureau, it's the local DA who's going to look at my case. And the local DA is, if you're just, like, at this point, they're literally just grabbing anyone who doesn't run fast enough during these protests and, like, hitting them with disorderly conduct or with, like, I forget what the other one. It's basically, like, failure to obey a police order. And the DA just throws all of those out. So, if people know that, oh, it's Portland Police Bureau arresting us tonight, it's just going to be the DA. So it's going to suck to spend the night in jail, but as long as I'm not caught, like, throwing a rock, if I get arrested, the DA is probably just going to throw out my case. But, opposed to, like, oh, it's, DHS is out there, so if they arrest me, it's going to be federal charges. And so it's been this crash course for the public, all these different layers of policing that really, like, there's no just, like you said, there's no just one policing entity. We're under the control of all of these overlapping layers. And it's, this whole movement has sort of exposed that as, like, who we face off against has shifted over time. So when when it was making big national news in early July, early to mid July, when we were facing off against DHS, like everyone, like that shit was real. Like everyone, that was probably like the closest. I think that I never would have thought we'd have gotten that close to like outright police state fascism. And it was pretty close to that. And I think people really realized like, oh shit, if we don't get out in the streets and like face this head on, like Portland is going to be, you know, we're going to be under a military police state or something.
About 7 or 8 years ago, I did some research where I was trying to figure out just how large the police state in the United States is. And by my calculation, in terms of the actual number of official law enforcement agents, if we count everything from local sheriff's deputies all the way up to FBI agents, there are probably about 1.5 million law enforcement agents in the United States. So roughly one for about every 275 Americans or something like that. And of course, they're all spread out through many different federal agencies, state police, local police departments. As I said earlier, local localities often have multiple police departments. Also, there's the tribal police for the Native American communities. That you've got the various border related police organizations and the ones that specialize in very localized policing, like at seaports and airports, at TSA and all that kind of stuff. Also the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, they have their own police department.
The post office
has a police department. The forestry services have a police department. Of course the IRS, the tax collection, you have what is literally a standing army in the United States. Which is interesting. If you go back and read the writings of the people who created the United States, that's one of the things I said. Well, we don't really want to have a standing army here. We had too many problems with that with Britain. We've got it. Even more so than the actual U.S. armed forces. In the number of active duty police in the domestic United States is larger, arguably, than the number of active duty military in the Army and Navy and Air Force and Marines. So that's how large our standing occupational army is in the United States. And whenever I've raised this issue with a lot of people, I say, well, we live in a police state. They say, well, that's crazy. We're not like Saddam Hussein or I'm like, no, the hallmark of a police state is not necessarily its brutality. It's not that they, actually run literal death camps or something like that, like the Third Reich. It's more just the pervasiveness of the police and of the state, as also the arbitrariness of it. The fact that laws and policies are so arbitrary. You can be arrested for all kinds of things. And I've heard about people being arrested on federal crimes for having shrimp packaged in a wrong kind of box or something like that. I heard about some guy that got arrested on federal charges for growing daffodils without a license or something. And whatever the context of that was, it's the kind of police state that you see written about in the Franz Kafka novels, where it's this kind of Byzantine labyrinth of bureaucracy that makes no sense and has no logic to it. And once you're in, it's kind of like quicksand that they trap you in. That's the kind of police state that we have. And I've had conversations about this with people who grew up in Eastern Europe, in places like the former Czechoslovakia, the former East Germany under the Stasi, under Erich Honecker, and that kind of stuff. And one thing that was a feature of those systems were they weren't all necessarily the kinds of systems where if you get caught jaywalking, they're going to take you out and shoot you. I mean, Nicolae Ceausescu's Romania was kind of like that. But a lot of those places, it was more just the arbitrariness of it all. They just had this massive bureaucratic apparatus with all these kinds of Byzantine, arcane laws and regulations. So anybody could be breaking the law at any time, and then they would just kind of make up the law as they went along. Well, yeah, you did this. So, yeah, this kind of sounds like this law here. So, yeah, we're going to prosecute you for this. That's the kind of police state that we have. And a lot of it, I think, is rooted in this whole process of over-criminalization that, even a lot of conservative think tanks have put out reports about this, talking about over-criminalization. We're talking about Republican-leaning, like think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and Cato Institute, you know, even they are saying, look, you know, we have an out-of-control policing system, we have an out-of-control prosecutorial system or legal system, and they'll talk about all the things you can potentially be arrested for, all the different kinds of contexts in which, you know, the police can come and, you know, basically kick in your door and shoot you with impunity and say, well, we felt threatened, you know, or whatever.
Right, yeah.
You know, in so many different kinds of contexts, that's the kind of police state that we have here. And that's why, you know, all of the protests and the riots and all that are the natural outgrowth of that. I mean, it's a backlash against the massive saturation of this police state in the wider society over the last half century or so.
Yeah, agreed. And it's interesting in the protests, like how the arbitrariness of all the laws plays out. And it's like, They want an excuse to come in and clear everyone off the streets and beat the crap out of people and shoot people. So like some nights they'll, you know, the gathering will start in a park, a city park, or it will be, you know, the police will push everyone into a park, and then they'll be like, oh, it's midnight, the park is closed. Like everyone has to leave the park now. And then nobody leaves the park, and they use that as the pretext to come in and tear gas everyone and beat the crap out of everyone. And people get arrested for it, like, oh, you were in a park after midnight. Like, and it's obviously they were just coming up with excuses. And then in the early stages, when all the protests were downtown at the Injustice Center and the federal courthouse, there's three, those in the IRS building, they're all lined up. Each one occupies a block, and they each face a city park. And two of those parks are City of Portland parks, and one is a federal park. It's owned by the feds. And like, the, you know, if everyone got pushed into the federal park, the feds would be like, the federal park is closed. Like, if you are in the federal park after blah, 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 you're subject to arrest. And then like, if you step into the street, the City of Portland is like, you're blocking traffic. Like, we're going to arrest you for blocking traffic. And then if you step into the city park, then the Portland police are like, the city park is closed. Like, you're being arrested for trespassing on the city park. And then if you're on the sidewalk in front of the courthouse, it's like, you're on federal property, we're arresting you for trespassing. So they can't, like, they just come up with all these various different excuses to arrest people, and whether or not the charges stick is kind of almost beside the point. The point is to you know, grab someone, arrest them, throw them on the ground. And like, they call, I forget what the stacking charges. So they get you for being in the park after midnight, and then they say, oh, you resisted arrest. Oh, you also, you know, committed disorderly conduct, whatever that means. Oh, you also, you know, felony riot. I'm like, I was just standing in the park with, you know, people protesting. Like, it's supposedly we have a First Amendment right here in the United States. But, you know, if they'll come up with excuses to grab you.
What has been the response of, say, normies, ordinary people in the Portland area to this whole series of events? When you mentioned that a lot of people have been radicalized by it, but one thing that we see being debated in the national media, given the election that's coming up, is, well, is this going to have a sort of a Nixon 68 type of backlash where, you know, Nixon ran as the law and order candidate, right, and all of this, you know, when all of the anti-war riots and civil rights movement and you know, student riots were going on. And there are some people who are making the argument, well, you know, the all of the uprisings that have happened over the last few months, that's going to push a lot of normie voters rightward, and they're going to vote for the guy they see as the law and order guy. And of course, Trump is trying to step in and play that role now.
Yeah.
Do you see this having that kind of effect, at least in the Portland area, or do you see it having the opposite effect, where people are being radicalized by these circumstances, or perhaps they are developing a more critical view of policing because of some of these incidents?
There's certainly a good contingent of people that, what did Martin Luther King Jr. call them? Moderate whites. He called them, when he said that the greatest enemy to the African-American is the moderate white. And we definitely have that contingent here in town, which is saying, like, all of this violence and looting and rioting is, you know, it's, what do they call it? It's providing the B-roll for Trump's campaign. He's going to scare everyone to vote for him. So there definitely is a contingent like that out here. They don't really have much of a voice, though. I mean, their voice is essentially the mayor Ted Wheeler, who is definitely echoing that sort of. I think you can find quotes of him. He said, like, you know, rioters are providing B-roll film for Trump every night that they're out there. But he is wildly unpopular on both the right and the left right now. He's likely going to lose very badly, and he's up for re-election in November. So I think we'll see whether or not Portland, which narrative Portland is kind of clinging on to. Certainly among the people I know, it's more of a radicalizing, this is more radicalizing the people I know more than it's pushing them toward that kind of like, well, we need law and order, you know, we need to stop all the violence so that we can stop Trump in November. But it's definitely there. But and granted, you know, I'm a radical person, so I mostly know people who are either radical themselves or lend themselves to being radicalized. But you do have the full spectrum of response. And I don't really see, aside from like some of the mainstream local media outlets, there is no, like, they don't have a whole lot of power. That sort of moderate voice does not really have a whole lot of power right now, because they're really under attack from both the right and the left right now.
Well, a parallel issue I'm curious about is what exactly has been the extent of the damage done by the, say, the riots in terms of, say, buildings destroyed, or because that seems to be an issue that some people are raising. They're saying, well, look, when you have people who own small businesses or shops, and a lot of them are immigrants or minorities, and they see their businesses getting trashed, mm-hmm. or something, or other people see this. And of course, this is a selling point that, say, the Trumpists and the Fox News crowd and all that have really pushed. They've really tried to push this. I'm curious as to what's happened with as far as scenarios like that. I know in my own local area, there has been, certainly been looting, and there were buildings set on fire and stuff like that. Mostly it happened in strip mall areas where the patrons were typically students and stuff like that. It's not something that's really spread into more conventional residential areas or more conventional business districts and that kind of stuff. It's been areas that were more adjacent to, say, very lower income communities, or where you have a lot of people who, you know, would be sympathetic to the protest movement anyway. But what's been the situation with that in Portland?
There's been kind of two, I think we can classify that in two general categories. And the first is the more like opportunistic looting and burning that happened in the early stages. And that really was confined to downtown. And downtown Portland, over every few years, it gets looted in one riot or another. But this time it was pretty widespread. And what got hit initially was like Louis Vuitton got hit. And there's like, you can find video of people going into Louis Vuitton and coming out with handbags. And like, I think the Nike store downtown and the Apple store and various different kind of like big corporate chain sort of businesses got hit in the first few nights. And there was some collateral damage with some smaller businesses, but you could literally see in many cases, like you'd see, you know, a storefront that was hit, and then like the Mexican restaurant, which is still open for business and fine, like not a spot of graffiti on it, no, like windows are fine. And then the next block, you know, you see the Nike store hit and the whatever store hit. But there was some Middle Eastern restaurant that got its window smashed or something like that. And that has happened, but I would say for the most part, it's been fairly targeted. And that's not to say that, you know, looting of small businesses hasn't happened, but for the most part, it's been pretty targeted. And after that very first wave, and like, keep in mind that downtown Portland businesses were already boarded up because of the coronavirus. Like, downtown was already kind of a ghost town. And a lot of, like, there's a lot of video out there, and like a lot of the claims about all the economic damage due to the riots are actually the economic damage of you know, the economy shutting down due to coronavirus. So downtown was already a ghost town. I think like a lot of the stores had already emptied their stores out just because they were closed due to the coronavirus. And then the second category is the anarchists and radical people who are targeting police buildings and associated police buildings. So they're targeting precincts like the North Precinct. Someone tried to start a fire, light the North Precinct on fire here in Portland, but it's attached to a really small kind of urban strip mall. Like it's not really like a suburb area, but it has like a strip mall attached to it. And then it's still very much in the city. And it's attached to all these black owned businesses. And so someone set fire to that building and they set fire to the black owned business side of it. And I think they were trying to set fire to the North Portland precinct, and it's attached. And, but actually protesters went and put that fire out because they, you know, there were people from the neighborhood who knew like, hey, like we can't set Mid-K Beauty on fire. It's a black owned business. And then the Portland Police Union building has been broken into and set on fire a few times. None of those fires have actually caught. I don't think we've had any buildings like burned to the ground like we saw in Minneapolis or in Kenosha.
It was similar in my area. Out on this main thoroughfare that's called Broad Street, on one side of the street, you have this long row of businesses, which are mostly small businesses, or they're owned by these independent proprietors, like these franchises of corporate chains. And a lot of these are owned by immigrants, like Middle Eastern immigrants and all that. That's on one side of the street. On the other side of the street, you have these strip malls where you have a Whole Foods, you have a Starbucks, you have a DTLR, a GameStop, all that kind of stuff. All of that got torched. I mean, they just set those buildings on fire. And then there was a Verizon on the other side of the street. There was a Verizon store. They went in and took all the phones, smashed out all the windows. But you had all these little mom and pop businesses, you know, like a Middle Eastern restaurant, some sort, just a localized barbershop type place. Yeah, that was all untouched. And of course, the people that owned those places, they would put up signs in the window saying, this is minority owned, this is black owned, or a lot of those had plyboard as well, in part because of the unrest, and in part because, like you were saying, a lot of them had shut down for the pandemic anyway. So yeah, it's interesting how a lot of those kinds of distinctions were being made, but I knew people that were involved in the protests that would say that you had people protesters that were trying to prevent looting of some businesses. Like there was this one pawn shop that a group of people were trying to loot, and then the protesters were blocking the looters from coming in. That's interesting. But then I also heard a lot of reports about the looting of larger places being very well organized as well. You would have people saying, okay, we're going to hit GameStop first, and we're going to hit Verizon, and then we're going to hit, you know, Walmart or whatever next. So it was, you know, somewhat planned, I guess. You know, I tend to think of that as sort of a grassroots level stimulus plan.
But I love that take on it.
Well, we've been going for about an hour and a half now, I guess. We don't want to, you know, take too much of people's time. What else would you care to add about to your analysis and your, or what other experiences do you have to share?
Well, I would just say that, you know, one thing we didn't talk a whole lot about is the infrastructure around these protests, just in parting. And, you know, I think anarchists really showed up. You know, Attack the System has been pretty critical of the trajectory of the anarchist movement. But here in Portland, I don't think Portland would be able to sustain 100 nights of rioting. And I like to call it rioting. A lot of people like to say, oh, it's protest. Like, no, we're rioting. This is a riot. But anarchists really showed up. And where it has really had an impact is in the decentralized mutual aid infrastructure that has grown up, that has been built around the protests. Like if you go to a protest, you're going to be fed, you're going to be given supplies. And if you get arrested, you're going to be bailed out. And there will be people on the ground doing jail support. When you come out of jail, they'll be there to give you a ride home. They'll be there to like feed you, like give you a change of clothes. like the infrastructure around all of this and how people have been taking care of each other has just been amazing. And like, I wish this was the revolution. I mean, I'll be proven wrong and this will turn into the revolution. But for me, this is like a smaller scale of what the revolution might look like. All of these decentralized mutual aid networks, and they're really just that. There's no centralized George Soros funding all of this. It's really just very grassroots, people donating $1 here, $5 there. And it's really what has sustained this movement over time, is like people really taking care of each other. And I think we've seen, I have now seen anarchism working on the street level. And if we can just like expand that out of protests and into communities, and mutual aid projects are starting to pop up in neighborhoods now, then, you know, now we're cooking with fire. If we can just expand that into people's everyday lives outside of protests, then it will be a huge win. And I hope that's what occurs.
Well, there are certainly plenty of prototypes for that. And we had this Chaz group in Seattle that developed this autonomous zone that was eventually repressed by the police, of course. But one thing I thought was particularly hilarious, though, is that when Chaz was going on, I think there was a murder that supposedly took place within the zone or something like that. And of course, all the talking heads were saying, aha, there's a murder that took place. Like there's never a murder that happens in any territory controlled by the state or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly.
No murders never happen anywhere else. So you have these prototypes like Chaz, and then you also have Chiron, I'm not sure if you pronounce it Chiron or Sharon in Spanish. Right. I failed Spanish.
Mexico. Cool. Yeah.
But you have that in Mexico, and then you've got the Morez district in southern Mexico, the Zapatista district, and of course you've got Rojava. So there's plenty of prototypes for this around the world. So that would be the idea, is take what you're describing and going on in Portland and expand that to other cities and other places, you know, just like we've seen in some of these other countries as well. And as you were saying, that's the revolution. We've got it.
Yeah. And I think like people here are avoiding the whole Chaz sort of, excuse me, the whole Chaz experience. And instead of creating an autonomous zone, I think what's happening is it's coming from, people are taking it to the neighborhoods instead. So instead of creating one autonomous zone, and the mayor here will not tolerate an autonomous zone. Like people have tried and it's been immediately broken up by the police. So instead of doing that, I think if people are focusing on, and I think they should focus on, neighborhood level mutual aid projects, building that from the ground up in the neighborhoods, not one place where it happens, but just have it grow up everywhere is kind of the idea right now. But that would be my parting thought, which is take these mutual aid networks, take this anarchism that we're seeing sustaining the street protests, and apply it to neighborhoods, people helping each other.
Okay, well, on that note, I guess that's a good place to stop. So thank you, Vince, for sharing your experiences and your information with us. And hopefully we can, maybe this will go on for another 100 days, and then we'll have you back in 100 days to talk about, you know, the 200th day anniversary of the uprising in Portland.
If I'm not in prison.
Okay. Well.
All right, thanks.